Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a privilege to be part of such prestigious conference. So I have divided this presentation in two parts. I'll be dealing with part one, and my colleague would be dealing with part two. I'll be dealing with three issues in my presentation. First would be to give you an insight of the plight of women in armed conflict in war times, their reasons and their consequences. Second, I would be dealing with what is meant by feminist perspective and how is it different from gender perspective. And thirdly, I'll be focusing on the feminist engagement with Rome Statute. So to begin with, it is important to understand that women suffer differently than men in armed conflict. Sexual violence, rape, and other forms of physical abuse are used against women to humiliate them, to terrorize them, or to dominate the members of the community they represent. It is often seen as a dishonor to the family rather than abuse of the physical person. The aim is to send a message to her community of the position of dominance which is being enjoyed by the perpetrators. So why is it so? Why is the reason for such kind of abuse during war times? The major reason is the patriarchal norms. Even during peacetime, women have a subordinate position in the society. This is the major reason for the vulnerability during sexual crimes, during armed conflict. Also, women suffer from double discrimination of not only the conflict, but the pre-existing gender oppression in the society. So we can say that sexual violence has two targets. First, the woman itself. Second, it is treated as a symbolic gesture sending a message to the second target, which can be the brother, the father, or the other male members of the community of the position of dominance that is being enjoyed by the perpetrators. To give you an exact picture of the conditions, I'd like to quote one of the statements made by the victim during analysis. You can see it on the screen as well. I'll read it. "During the war, army men made my father sleep with me. And when he refused, they tied him up with ropes and put a pistol to his head and made him lie down on me. He tried to penetrate me, but he could not, as the army men pierced me down with the pistol. And he saw the blood and lost desire. They took my father aside and shot him dead with a bullet." These are some of the examples and the statements given by people who are abused. Moving on, the consequences of sexual violence, which all of you, I guess, know. They're social as well as physical. They're abandoned by their family. They're shunned by the society. Married men often presume that the woman had given consent for rape. If the rape victim survives and gets pregnant, husband and families are reluctant to take the responsibility of the child or to bear the child. Physically, there's risk of pregnancy, of course, HIV/AIDS, permanent damage to the reproductive systems, severe physical injuries, and many other diseases. Okay, now the second part of my presentation, which is the main focus of our paper. What is feminist perspective? And how do we differentiate it from a gendered perspective? So while analyzing any crime during preliminary examination phase, a gendered perspective only seeks to acknowledge the wide difference between the status, the roles, the need of men and women. The policy papers say so, but it doesn't go beyond that. A feminist perspective, on the other hand, challenges these inequalities, these differences, and these power dynamics. It challenges the oppressive position of women and the assumption that sexual violence are natural consequences of war. It thus tries to mend them and not merely admit the existence of them. The third part, feminist engagement with Rome Statute. Rape and sexual violence were not defined before the Rome Statute in ICTR and ICTY. They were recognized first time as an act of genocide or torture in the case of Prosecutor versus Akayasu. We all know that. Rome Statute was the first international instrument which defined rape and other sexual violence crimes. Of course, the International Criminal Tribunal played a very important role in the foundation of the codification of the statute. Also, another important point to be mentioned during the codification phase of Rome Statute was the role played by a women's human rights activist called Women Caucus for Gender Justice. Their objective was to ensure that a gender perspective is incorporated in the statute. They demanded a lot of things. I'll give you an example of one of them. They demanded that the word gender and gender-based crimes should be used instead of sex and sex-based crimes, because the latter talks about more of biological components, while gender includes cultural, social, and other factors as well. And this was thus incorporated into statute successfully. Some of the important provisions in the Rome Statute with regard to the sexual violence offences, I have given three of them, the main ones. So there's Article 7.1g, which talks about rape, sexual slavery, enforced prostitution, forced pregnancy, enforced sterilization, and any other form of sexual violence. There's Article 7.1h, which talks about crime against humanity, persecution against any identifiable group or collectivity on various grounds, including gender. And then finally, Article 8. It includes any other sexual violence constituting a grave breach of the Geneva Convention regarding war crimes. Having discussed the important provisions and having discussed what is meant by feminist perspective, now the main part that during preliminary examination, how far has the OTP been successful in prosecuting people who are responsible for such crimes? Rome Statute as such has been applauded as a progressive international instrument from the feminist perspective. It has included all the definitions and everything that a substantive law can. But on the procedural part, it has failed to end the impunity with respect to gender-based crimes. I have cited three cases here. First one is the case of Prosecutor versus Lubanga. Here the OTP failed to frame any charges against sexual violence, despite being a lot of evidence regarding the same. The second is the case of Prosecutor versus German Katanga, in which ICC held that the charges were not comprehensive that were made by OTP. And the third one recently, in October 2016, was the case of Al Mehdi, where the OTP failed to frame charges for sexual and gender-based crimes, even though credible reports suggest that these crimes were occurred. So now the question comes that what is the reason for such failure? If everything is mentioned in the Rome Statute, then where is it lacking? Where is the OTP and the preliminary examination lacking? For this, it becomes necessary to understand and comprehend the policies and the procedure of preliminary examination, which is carried on by the OTP, which would be dealt by my colleague. Thank you.
So thank you, Pratibha, for that. It's a great honor to be able to present among such stalwarts. So I'll start off by saying with great humility that, yes, our understanding of international criminal law may not be as intensive or as exhaustive as many of the legal scholars sitting here. However, we have tried to analyze and apply uniform principles according to and across various preliminary examinations that we have seen. So the very first aspect that I would deal with is the policies that outline the OTP's preliminary examinations, that is the policy paper of 2013, as well as the policy paper of 2014, which respectively talk about preliminary examinations and sexual and gender-based crimes. So whether there are any points of clash between the two, can we possibly reduce the differences that exist in terms of the policies and make them more congruent? The second aspect would be the feminist shadow of complementarity, which first came about in Mr. Heller's article in 2006. And he talked about how, although the Rome Statute and the ICC establish a high standard of due process rights within a jurisdiction, on the international arena, However, once you try to reciprocally reflect them on the domestic jurisdiction, it's not as effective. And the reason being that the threshold for understanding complementarity is a little low, as a result of which these due process rights are not reflected in domestic jurisdictions, so thereby creating a feminist shadow of sorts. So is that shadow there? Possibly, do we see that through the preliminary examinations that we have come across? Those would be the determinations that we would be trying to make. So the first aspect, obviously, everyone knows about the preliminary examination report of 2013, which subsequently was followed by the 2014 preliminary, the policy paper on sexual and gender-based crimes, which also incorporated within it preliminary examinations. However, there were certain distinctions that, or maybe certain roadblocks that the 2014 paper was trying to overcome. And how they overcame that was, number one, incremental use of, increasing the use of incremental convictions, that is a bottom-to-up approach, gathering evidence and then trying to build the investigation as you get more and more evidence. Using broadened charging, but most importantly, acknowledging the difference in terms of gender hierarchies or social hierarchies and gender roles. And the most important aspect that comes out of it is this. It fails to distinguish, and there's a very fine line of distinction between the feminist perspective and the gender perspective. Because if we go back through history and we trace the scholarly articles, we see that in 1955, John Money first published the distinction between sex and gender per se, that there are sexually assigned roles, and then there is a gender identity, and there is a biological identity that is attached to you. This distinction, I'm sorry, is not reflected in the 2014 policy paper. Building on that, we see that the distinction between the feminist perspective and the gender perspective is, simply put, this. If you have different genders, would you compartmentalize them and possibly give them different standards while you're trying to assess complementarity, while you're trying to assess whether there is a genuine national proceeding or an investigation happening in a domestic jurisdiction? Or would you possibly apply an omnibus approach to all the three genders and all three victims? The second part of that would be that when you talk about the difference or the disparity in gender roles between the perpetrator and the victim, that is what the policy paper tries to talk about. And this is not more of a criticism, but more of a request for clarification, because the policy paper seems to be silent on this, so therefore it is not really clear as to what is the mindset of the OTP when you're trying to assess complementarity. And the idea behind that is that although there is a disparity between the perpetrator and the victim, is the OTP also analyzing the disparities that exist between victims of different genders altogether? And that is also important. So therefore, it may be a fine line of distinction. However, it can also be seen through the policy papers that since it is silent, maybe the OTP needs to come out with a clarification of sorts to maybe amend that, maybe modify it. Then thereafter, we go on to the feminist shadow of complementarity, as Mr. Heller talked about. And there were quite a few, there are quite a few preliminary examinations existing as of now, which are trying to assess sexual and gender-based crimes. The first of them would be obviously the example of Guinea and Colombia. And there are quite a few authors over here who have talked about Colombia, have talked about Guinea as well. Colombia, on one hand, offers a positive outlook in that sense, because there were quite a few criticisms that came about in 2013 and 14 that quite a few crimes were not even incorporated in the domestic penal code. However, after the reform of 2015, we now see that enforced sterilization or forced pregnancy have now been included into the domestic penal code. So Colombia offers a positive example on one hand, but it also at the same time does not really disclose the amount of convictions, because the information that is readily available in the public sphere is very scant. As a result of which, it's a little difficult to assess whether this preliminary examination is actually headed in the right direction or not. The second example would be that of Guinea. I'm sorry. And Guinea's case, again, the preliminary examination has been commencing since 2009. It's been 7 years, 8 years now. And the Minister of Justice has made a commitment of sorts, suggesting that a trial will commence in 2017. Now, I may be new to international criminal law, but at least with so far as India is concerned, there is a right to fair trial. So if there is a right to fair trial, could we possibly extend this to be a right to prolong trial? Nobody would ever imagine that. There is never a right to prolong trial, and there is absolutely no right to a promised trial after 8 years. So at the end of the day, maybe we have to look back and just introspect and see what is the purpose of a preliminary examination supposed to be. Because when you start looking at it from a feminist perspective, you start looking at it from a victim-centric approach. Therefore, trying to end the impunity of crimes, trying to ensure that the grievances of these victims are completely satisfied. And when you try and look at it from that approach, you see that these trials have either not started, or they have started but not in sufficient number or quantity. So then, is the preliminary examination approach, or maybe the approach of the OTP, really successful, or is it failing us? That's really a question that I'm not sure. I mean, I don't have the answer to that, to be very honest. But yes, positive complementarity does suggest and does give out a few positive reforms in that sense. But are we really doing enough? That is the question. So thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.